Santa Monica, 1936. My day begins. The Western Ocean slides up to Louis B. Mayer's private beach and leaves a slug's breath of cold foam behind. It's a gray, woolen December morning. I am a few hours old. Santa Monica is a perfect grid of bungalows awakening toward the coast. Marlowe finds the tough cops here, men in hats and thugs in pinstripe suits. I am a few hours old. I am going to be an only child. My mother, innocent as I, will never have another. A Cadillac limousine pulls up to Mr. Mayer's Sunday beach retreat, and he, the ugly little man, finds his way through archways of tile and into the car. On the ride to Culver City, he reads about the King and Mrs. Simpson. LB loves kings. He is a king himself. Out beyond 3 miles, gambling ships ride at umbilical anchor in the wake of Catalina. Tonight their lights will glitter on the water. The carousel on the pier will pipe old songs. Benny Goodman broadcasts Swing from Avalon Ballroom. I wake. I sleep. I wake again. My father will sleep all his married life in twin beds. Mr. Mayer likes twin beds. Even though in real life kings and would-be queens scramble together like sex-mad fish pulled out of the spermy surf in the fullness of the moon, Mr. Mayer keeps the beds apart. It's going to be a fine day. Mother remembers how fine the California days used to be before a million incinerators cooked and ate the day's garbage. Marlowe spoons sugar into his AM Java in a diner on Wilshire, where fresh pies repeat themselves and warm light angles off polished aluminum. Mayer mourns poor Irving, so suddenly dead, like King Edward, who'll never work again in his town either, spooning sugar into his AM Java. My father, young, thin inside a double-breasted pinstripe, pours in the real cream and moves the spoon around, touches the polished aluminum aircraft skin with his flat, square fingers, sees his face reflected, Gable's mustache, trim and dark on his lip. LB lunches with Gable at the commissary, eating chicken soup. I drink my bottled milk, feel the pain of birth and circumcision, try to focus, reach fists out toward the lights. Marlowe drives back to L.A. in an old coupe convertible, never suspecting Bogart will eventually hunt him down in an old garage in the rain, a case of taken identity. I cry at sleep. The sun swings overhead and flattens itself in a prize silk ribbon against the sea. Mr. Mayer goes back to Beverly Hills tonight. The Kings push on for Switzerland, Chasen's, or the Strip. Marlowe pushes his hat back to his hairline, beds down in Laurel Canyon, dreams of perfect crimes and vulnerable Mexicans. In one white bungalow, my father goes to bed alone and flies the China Clipper in his sleep. My mother never sleeps, and in her wakefulness promises herself no brothers or sisters for me. Too much pain, so shy. And I ride like a gambling ship, still inside the fluids of the dream, the months of tides ebbing, waves sweeping softly over and again, tracing lines of light behind my eyes. One, two, three, four.
Georgie, tire biter. He's a spy and a girl delighter.
Well, this is George Tirebiter, and whenever I'm in St. Louis and the rain is falling outside the window, I turn on the radio to FM 88 KDHX in the city of the Silver Arches.
Okay, there's George Tirebiter himself, and on the line with us here, the man who created George Tirebiter, Dave Osman, and also Phil Proctor from the Firesign Theater.
Howdy. What an amazing archive of stuff you have there.
It's scary, isn't it?
It really is. George in one of his off-guard moments.
I didn't know that George had a whistle like that. It was those bad teeth he had that time.
I think he was. That was when he had. You know, he had his. He had his jaw straightened.
Was that what it was?
That must have been it. He sounded like that that character in Winnie the Pooh, the little gopher.
That's right, he did.
Speaking of which, at some point, if we have the time, I want to play the recording of you guys doing Eeyore's Birthday.
Oh, that's a really favorite. Wonderful piece. I wish that we could make that available, but of course that's doubly, triply, and quadruply copyrighted by other people. So the fact that it went out on the air once live and somebody captured it is completely by chance and has nothing to do with anything commercial. But it was a wonderful reading. Peter and I used to do that because our birthdays are about a week apart. And we used to make sure that we read Eeyore's birthday every December or late November, sometime between his birthday and mine, whatever radio show came closest, why we would do that that piece together or with the whole group if they were available.
Ladies and gentlemen, the perennial candidate for vice president on the Natural Surrealist Party ticket, let us welcome George Leroy Tirebiter.
Thank you, Peter. Well, as you know, the Natural Surrealist Party is extremely proud of its long traditions dating as far back as 1972.
That's a long way, George.
Yes, and of course, many of you in the audience will perhaps remember the promises we made in that very early time. One man, one channel.
Uh-huh.
Now we say one person, one home page.
Right, right. One bozo, one hot button, you know?
Right. Yeah. And there's one organism, one vote.
Oh, yeah.
I will be back to that in a moment,
as
you know. And, of course, the guaranteed annual year.
Love it.
This year, we are promising, the Natural Surrealist Party is promising, that this guaranteed annual year will move no faster than the speed of life.
I love it. I absolutely love it. But what's this I hear about you narrowing and focusing the platform of one organism, one vote, to extend citizenship to all the great apes?
Well, you know, it's my response. The vice president, of course, is virtually president. And
yes.
So I can do just about anything I want to do. perfectly legal. So I would like to introduce to you a dear friend of mine, a supporter of mine.
Oh,
here he is, Cheetah, ladies and gentlemen. There he is. Come on. Cheetah, behave yourself. Living out there for the last 20 years in Tarzan.
Oh, the George Burns of chimpanzees. Yes. I love him.
Sweetie pie. All right. Now, as you know, as you could tell from his actions there recently, don't eat my script. That's very nice. Genetically, only 1% of DNA away from us human beings.
That's
only 1%.
Absolutely
99% human.
Yeah.
Yes.
What did he say?
Jane is only a Jane, but a good cigar is a smoke. The great apes, that's the chimpanzees, the orangutans, and the gorillas, support strong family values.
I'm glad.
They certainly reject guerrilla warfare, as we know. And they favor lower taxes because... Well, it's hard to reach the high ones when your knuckles are on the ground.
Yeah. Well, it's going to take a long time,
Actually,
I think.
Most people's knuckles are on the ground these
days.
Yeah,
just scraping by.
Yeah.
You know, it's going to take a while for these reforms to kick in, George. How are you going to tell a 2-ton gorilla that they can't vote?
It's a tough one.
How do you do it?
Well, with great tact,
Yes.
And American Sign Language. Watch this now. You see, he's right away.
Marvelous, George.
Thank you. Not insane.
George LeRoy, Tirebiter.
David, you know, everybody thinks of you as being part of the Firesign Theater, but you really had a long career in radio and as a poet as well, and you tied both of those together in the 50s. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Well, I got started in radio, actually, yeah, it was in the 50s. It was in 1959 in New York City. So I had, before the whole Firesign got together, which was late in 1966 and then really in 1967, I'd been working for all of that time in radio at first a commercial station that later became one of the very early public stations, WBAI in New York, and then in Los Angeles at KPFA.
Yes, you all recognize the saloon song from The Floating Prince by Stein. Now, here's the lilting revenge duet from Il Vino Confuso.
Don tarde morde et en porco! Chi dite? Elete! Oh, il morte!
Isn't that beautiful? It's by a great Italian composer. Yes, he's dead now, but lives on in stereo hi-fi.
I was the first stereo broadcast in New York City. I was one side of the stereo broadcast. It was two FM stations in New York, and WBAI was one of them.
Right.
1959.
On this 12-inch record album of 40 great unclaimed melodies. Yes, friends, if you were to go into a record store and ask for them, they would think you were crazy. Hello, I'm Don Giovanni, and I'm proud to speak for the Musical Heritage Surplus Club of Hong Kong. Wouldn't you like to raise the level of your home? Bring your family closer together around the hi-fi? Listening to such immoral pieces of art like Bidet's The Fountain or The Duke's Duet from Il Schizofreno. Yes, friends, if you act now, we'll include at absolutely no cost to anyone this collection of 40 familiar sound effects. Who can forget? And remember? And well, friends, they're all yours. Yes, siree, friends, and if you act in time, we'll throw in this three-record boxed bonanza of timeless big band hymns. Titles like In a Persian Melon, My Spanish Suitcase, The Happy Plunderer, Waltz for Three People, and the Hawaiian Hallucination Song. A cultural landslide to fill your home entertainment center. Right now, to this address.
Right, a Chinese surplus music deal, Hollywood Box 415, California.
And these were FMs, and in those days, FM was a fairly experimental kind of medium, really. It was very free-form. The stations allowed the staff to produce any sorts of programs that we wanted to, and I started out at the beginning in New York in those late 50s, early 60s days, doing a series of interviews with the hottest contemporary poets on the scene. Poetry was a very big thing then, as I think it is now. And these things have a cycle, of course, 30 years or something like it, generational. And so I was talking to the likes of Allen Ginsberg and the beat poets and that period, around that period of time. And then producing programs of music, public affairs, drama, literature, all kinds of things. It was a very active, wonderful, busy time. And into that time came Peter and Phil Austin and later on Phil Proctor. So
that's when you moved to the West Coast then.
Yeah, after I moved to the West Coast, we actually met I met Peter Bergman at part of a fundraising marathon at KPFK in Los Angeles.
What was your first day like on the air?
My first day on the air, oh boy, I was a replacement announer
in New York. Yeah.
And even though it was the early days of FM, you know, it was still New York City, so you could figure you had quite a few people out there listening. I was all thumbs, of course. And the thumbs were very necessary on the primitive equipment that we had at that time. Your thumb flicked the switch over that it turned on the microphone.
Mm-hmm.
And then you potted up, you know, turned the round thing. It was none of these slide things that go up and down. I don't know what you have in front of you.
I have thumb switches here with turning pots. David.
Turning pots.
That's
well,
right.
You see, some things never change.
I
remember once kicking out the whole thing was plugged into the wall, of course, just plugged in like a heater or a radio or anything. And leaning back after I had done my announcements and kicking the plug right out of the wall, the whole thing went dead. Oh, and I broke up during a commercial more than once. You know, I found myself saying things that just seemed absurd to me, but I hadn't rehearsed them, you know.
Did you leave your mic open during the commercials at all?
Well, I was doing them live. A lot of
you were reading them.
Were just live. They were part of the show. I'd spit, you know, we had a show tunes, you know, Broadway show tunes program where we had an overture, and then you had to drop in the commercial message or the announcement right there in the little hole in the music. You had to say, Thorns presents Front Row Center. You had to drop in the little break, so... All live, all of it live, and we had people coming into the studio. We had we had folk music groups and all kinds of stuff like that that I had to set up in the studio, multi microphones, and put them on the air live.
Wow, you said something interesting that you thought that radio commercials were like poems. Could you explain that a little bit?
Well, it's short form writing, and most poems, at least certainly the kind of poetry that I write, generally tends to be short forms. commercials have a condensed message. They have a drama of their own. They're like small plays, really.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the heightened word imagery that reminds me of poetry. And when I started doing satires of commercials with Fire Sign,
mm-hmm.
My history of writing poems really was very helpful in getting the form of the commercials right. Also, of course, like poetry, commercials are meant to be read aloud. Radio commercials are meant to be spoken, and I think poetry is as well meant to be spoken. So I've written poems in the forms of commercials, and commercials in the form of poems, and done them as humor over the years, and it's kind of a regular part of my performance.
Do you prefer doing short poems then?
Well, I do. I mean, that's really, I tend to write short poems, highly condensed imagery, and occasionally, you know, over the years, I've done more extended pieces, more like little short stories or, you know, things like that. But I'm not an epic writer.
No epic poems.
No, not many.
Okay, well, we hope to be hearing some of these poems when you come back after our break.
Okay.
Have you got something lined up for us?
I do. There's some things I can read for you. I'm getting ready right now for a big kind of retrospective poetry reading in the little town of Langley here on Whidbey Island, where
is that
I live.
Near the Air Force Base out there?
No, well away from the Air Force
Base.
We're down in cow country.
In cow country.
Yeah.
Well, great. Let me just have a few seconds more here. We're all looking forward to that. David Osman, of course, you've been writing poetry since you were very young, you know, we're really looking forward to hearing some of that. So,
well, good. Well, I started when I was in high school. I've actually published my first book at when I was a senior in high school.
Okay.
As so many poets, you have to do it yourself.
That's right. So we're going to put you back in hold hell.
Okay.
And go to the sports. Thank you, David.
Right.
Hey, we're back live now after those commercial poetry there. And we're with David Osman, who's going to be reading some of his poetry. David, are you there?
I am here.
Oh, great. So what have you selected for us today?
Well, a couple of things. One of the kinds of poetry that I tend to write, I don't write, I find. And I call it found poetry. It can be things out of newspapers or sometimes just pieces of paper I find on the floor. And often I'll put together little like little Xerox booklets of these and pass them around at poetry readings, that kind of thing.
Right.
Here's a typical example, if you like. This was something that was found in a newspaper. It's called Senator Packwood's Question.
Okay.
Some men are as suave as Cary Grant, and others have the motor skills of Quasimodo. If you approach a woman and she rebuffs you and you say, that's it, and you're a gentleman, you don't pursue her simply because you made an approach to her, even if unartful, are you guilty?
Well, that has a nice humorous bent to it.
Actual quote.
That's great.
Senator Packwood. Yeah, I like to find those kinds of things around on television. And you know, they're everywhere. Poetry is truly everywhere.
Now, do you do some of that randomly, or also, or just?
No, although I'm a great fan of the composer John Cage, who wrote according to rules of chance. Generally speaking, that's not the way I do it. There are things that I just collect over a period of time, and finally, it comes. The moment to roll them all together, and then I do that.
Great. Well, have you
some things are observational. Here's one called Winter Night, New Mexico, from a time that I was living in Santa Fe, as the poem starts. 1983, on the plaza in Santa Fe. Card-carrying Indian matron, left hand full of turquoise and silver in the alcoholic light. Put out of some tourist chili trap. And don't come back again, you hear? Understand? Her handful of beads dangling while Kit Carson kicks her in the ass and pelts her spine with frozen apricots.
Wow. Kind of a
sarcastic poem about that's something I really saw happen.
Oh, man. Let's hear some more.
The history of the American Indian is something I got involved with during the 60s, first doing a radio show of my own and then doing a show with Phil and Peter from the Fireside. We went out to the Hopi Reservation in northern Arizona one very cold winter day. As a matter of fact, it was for the winter solstice celebration, which is called the Soyal celebration. Snowy night, many, many miles from anywhere on three mesas overlooking a vast falling away of desert. You can see 75, 80 miles in the distance in every direction. The oldest constantly inhabited site in the United States, they say, is Old Oriabi, the village of Old Oriabi on one of these three mesas. Been there, they can, I hear, find trash of human civilization on the surface of the ground just about, that goes back a couple of thousand years. So they've been there for a long time, the Hopi have. Watching it come and go. As I sat in my Volkswagen bus, we all had Volkswagen buses and old clothes in those days. I sat in my Volkswagen bus that night, just at the time when the Kachinas came up out of the bowels of the earth to distribute the little feathers, which were the tokens of the new season coming along. Just at that time, and a mile or two away from the village, lying in the bus, I heard the music of the spheres. A great chime, as if the whole dome of heaven had been struck. Can't explain it. Certainly weren't any PA systems out there. One of the most remarkable noises I've ever heard, sounds I've ever heard.
FX minus one. Tirebiter.
Yes? Oh.
I'd like you to meet Hoppy Hoppenhauer.
Oh.
He'll kind of give you a ringside blow by blow, all right?
Glad to meet you, sir. What did you say? Take out your earplugs, sir. Your earplugs?
Oh, there we are. Yes, well, Dr. Hoppenhauer, I'm glad to meet you. It's a pleasure.
Call me Hoppy, sir.
No.
Very glad to meet you. I seldom go to the movies, Mr. Tirebiter, but the president showed me one of your pictures at the White House when I was a guest in 43.
Really?
Get our minds off the damn war, he said.
Oh, well, I didn't know that.
We all had martinis, and I'm afraid Mrs. R. might have slept through the last part, but the president especially liked that song about bringing the war back home.
Oh, yes, bringing the warm back home. And lots of chorus girls. Yes, it was wonderful.
I've been told you're Mr. Pingo's special representative. Mm-hmm. I hope you'll be able to figure a way to get this thing out of the hands of the military and let young Americans get a listen to it.
Well, I thought this was our ultimate secret weapon, Doctor.
That can only be used against people, sir. I never wanted this. My interest in sonic reinforcement was always strictly theoretical. Uh-huh. A question of fundamental research. I always liked sound, Mr. Tirebiter. Sound and arithmetic. If I showed you a diagram for that thing out there, you would not have the faintest idea what it could do.
No.
90% pure arithmetic. 10% magnetism.
Really?
General Bully found out some of the boys and I were working on this thing, and he convinced us that without it, we'd lose the Cold War.
Oh.
The urge to find out if our arithmetic could be made to have a material form to walk like a man, if you see what I mean.
Oh.
Well, I regret to say it was too great a temptation for us, and we built it.
Really? Well, sounds like the story for a great movie someday, the Whopper and the Tweety, huh?
Is
could be. Well,
Ten.
Nine. Be. Is this it?
This is it.
Well, eight. Good luck.
You better put those earplugs back in,
seven,
sir.
I'll do that.
Six. Five. Four. Three, two, one.
Inferno. As if all the noise of the universe was liberated at the same instant.
The ultimate weapon.
Jeez. No, that's if they use it, Mickey. If they use it, which would be too terrible to contemplate. You know, after it went off, Dr. Hoppenhauer turned to me and he quoted something about 1,000,000 points of light from the Tibetan Book of the Dead. General Bully quoted Walt Whitman, I think it was. Maybe it was Walt Disney. I don't know. Something about hound dogs. No one really heard the quotes, of course, because our ears were still ringing. You know, Hoppy says they can scale a thing down for home use, but it'd still be the end of the world as we know it, Mickey. Listen, I've got to call Pingo.
Yeah, I know a nice, quiet place with the phone, George. Come on. I'll introduce you to a friend of mine.
Well?
Very influential art dealer in town here. Specializes in cowboy crap, statues.
Yeah,
related to European royalty. She's quite a woman.
Well, yes. All right. If she wouldn't mind my making a long-distance call.
No problemo. She's got a sweet little place over the gallery. Chilies hanging down from the rafters, buffalo skulls, no Navajo rugs, adobe as hell, right up the canyon.
Oh.
Come on, George. The natives are rustlers.
Natives are rustlers. That's a good one, yeah.
Well, anyway, the history of the Indians, this is a look at it. And as I say, you can just shuffle up this history any way you want. It doesn't matter, really, where you start, because it always comes out the same. When you saw them, you knew how they moved, like bison or grass fire, slowly. The sum of those things you know is what they were beginning to forget, and I reach past what I know to remember them. When it was all gone, all of it, there was still a center. They never knew you kept it. They knew what they were doing, like dull birds scraping the sea in the short grass, but never wandering, always with death in their bellies. Some tried to make the land grow, but could not understand the way life came from it, and could not understand isolations and distances. So they came, with their names as baggage, their men's names forgotten, and you watched while the maps were drawn and the rain stopped falling. You, old man, after the last fight, you walked up to their eyes and spit their bullets out of your shirt. They knew what night was, but had forgotten about the stars, except mariners, and it's hard to change the sea much. They couldn't kill water like men. Some knew what to do with where they found themselves. They found its corners. Their eyes are eagles now. They move. You went running, footprints in the grass, animals in the leaves. My mouth breaks against your language. They were coming. Rising, you speak. The understanding is not words, but split rocks and corn growing. They need to know which way the wind blows. To play the victim, they fought the battle first. You ran bravely. And just to show you how this always turns out the same, you know, you have to shuffle a deck of cards 7 times to truly shuffle a deck of cards. Did you know that? It's a true fact, a true science fact that I've learned from my years in now dealing with the professional science writer. 7 shuffles. Of course, you have to get the cards in between each other to make that work. It's hard. But seeing as how you're in the mood up there on the mesa, you old man, after the last fight, you walked up to their eyes and spit their bullets out of your shirt. They knew what they were doing, like dull birds scraping the sea in the short grass, but never wandering, always with death in their bellies. Oh, they knew what night was, but had forgotten about the stars, except mariners, and it's hard to change the sea much. They couldn't kill water like men. Some knew what to do with where they found themselves, found its corners. Their eyes are eagles now. They move. The sum of those things you know is what they were beginning to forget, and I reach past what I know to remember them. When it was all gone, all of it, there was still a center. They never knew you kept it. When you saw them, you knew how they moved, like bison or grass fire, slowly. So they came, with their names as baggage, their men's names forgotten, and you watched while maps were drawn and the rain stopped falling. You went running, footprints in the grass, animals in the leaves. My mouth breaks against your language. They were coming. Rising, you speak. The understanding is not words, but split rocks and corn growing. They need to know which way the wind blows. To play the victim. They fought the battle first. You ran bravely. Some tried to make the land grow, but could not understand the way life came from it, and could not understand isolations and distances. Hope, he said.
Got anything else lined up?
Yeah, sure. Here's when I was wooing my wife, Judith, about 10 years ago. I wrote this one for her called Six Good Reasons. Because if I adore you, you ignore me. Because there's no time but your time. Because I'm hungry as an empty house and you give me no furniture. Because we missed the lilacs and chestnuts when you took spring away. Because loving you gives birth to silence. Because nothing starts until you arrive.
Oh, I like that, David.
Little love poem. That's from a book called Thin Boundaries.
Hmm.
And I put these things together in books, and I've published quite a few in the past, though none in the last 10 or 15 years. The Santa Fe poem is from a book called American Parts, which poems written all over the country in different places. A lot of these are not really readable on the air, partly because of the language and just partly because of the content, which is often, you know, out of common speech, and it's we don't speak commonly on the radio.
Right. Well, I really enjoyed that, David. I'm going to try to get you to read some more on the going up towards the top of the hour.
All right.
For our last, I wish we could go on for another 30 seconds here. So you are still currently writing?
Oh, yes. And as I say, I'm doing, I'm both writing poetry and finding it. I have a new little book that I'll send you off, which is of found poetry. And it's all in strange languages. Literally things that I found on the floor. Xeroxes found on the floor.
Well, that sounds wonderful. Okay.
Fresh air and water. Exposed fish gill. Mountain summit stone. A large wallet of dark, soft leather. Utopia or Oblivion by Buckminster Fuller.
Unicorn horn.
Mist enveloped stone. $365.
A bicycle.
Silkworm reeling silk.
Moon shadow stone.
3 5-pound notes.
Suspenders.
Shifting turning dragon.
Mandarin duck stone.
A much-visaed Greek passport.
A record by the Chambers Brothers.
Fish, eye to eye.
Sentinel stone.
5 folded sheets of pinkish onion skin paper.
Some cedar and redwood shake shingles.
Heart-sharing swallows.
Watergate stone.
Postcard photograph of a dusky woman.
A pound of hash.
Kingfishers intertwined.
Wave receiving stone.
A large silk handkerchief yellow with age.
A hash pipe.
Joined mandarin ducks.
Flying geese stone.
A thin sheaf of Mr. Joel Cairo's engraved cards.
A letter from my girlfriend Joy. Sky soaring butterfly.
Fish diverting stone.
Ticket for an orchestra seat at the Geary Theater.
Familia nuts and raisins.
Rear flying wild duck.
Nameless stone.
3 gaily colored silk handkerchiefs.
Some flower and vegetable seeds.
Recumbent covered pine.
Planet stone.
A platinum longine watch.
Camping equipment.
Bamboos converging on the altar.
Tortoise stone.
A platinum and red gold chain.
What kinds of leaflets?
The seagull soars.
Crane stone.
A small pear-shaped pendant of some white metal.
A joint.
The wild horse leaps.
Mirror stone.
A handful of United States, British, French, and Chinese coins.
Baby slings.
Fast-stepping steed.
Guest honoring stone.
A ring holding half a dozen keys.
An ecology symbol.
The horses shaking hooves.
Shoe removing stone.
A silver and onyx fountain pen.
Women's liberation information.
The white tiger jumps.
Sleeping tiger stone.
a metal comb in a leatherette case,
articles on Vietnam and Korea,
dark affixed cicada,
long boat stone,
a nail file in a leatherette case,
pantyhose,
mountain goat facing a tree,
magician's hat stone,
street guide to San Francisco,
a Colonel Sanders Kentucky Fried Chicken,
a phoenix frolics at the Cinnabar Hole,
a Southern Pacific baggage check,
Snoopy comic strip,
a great bird soars over a dark
sea,
faint scent stone,
a half-filled package of violet pastilles,
ticket signs,
wailing monkey embracing a tree,
nail stone,
a Shanghai insurance broker's business card,
stupid smile pin,
cat and rat share a hole.
Poor stone.
Four sheets of Hotel Belvedere writing paper.
1 cubic foot of sweet clean air.
The donkey of early, mid, and late spring.
Diseased stone.
A paper bag.
A flute.
The dog of early, mid, and late.
Dead stone.
A pickle.
I'm writing a series of found poems right now called Unwanted Poetry. and it's titled after the idea. There was this story. Can I tell the story?
Yes, go
there
for it.
There was a story when the gays in the military crisis was really coming to a boiling point, if you can imagine such a thing truly happening over this issue about a year ago, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So as this was coming out, the Navy finally passed their version of what was going to pass for the code, the official behavioral code, and it divided up things that you could do into green light, yellow light,
and red light. Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Okay. Well, one of the yellow light items on this list was unwanted poetry. And when I read this, you know, all poetry is unwanted. I mean, it's by definition unwanted. Nobody wants a poem. What do you mean?
I suppose ability to interior decorate was also a yellow light.
I could have been, yes, asking someone over to see if they could redo your blinds or whether you should have levelers or not in your stateroom. Gosh, I don't know. I just felt that that was extraordinary when it happened.
Yes.
All the opinions on this program are being of mine alone and not of the station, or good gracious, its supporters.
Well, mine, if I agree.
I mean, the prophetic aspect of the fire sign is certainly its science fiction aspect, in that science fiction writers attempt to project into the future based on what we know about the present. Science fiction or speculative fiction tends take what is happening in the present and project it in some way or another into the future, which is what I did in that Years in Your Ears piece. It occurred to me at the time that the huge bulk of our audience was probably born about 1950, that was a good median year. Now, I didn't even have the sense really then to think of the baby boom. It wasn't being named as such.
Yeah.
It really is now started in 1947, I guess, is the beginning of the baby boom.
Stop making babies!
It was pretty close to the beginning, 1950. Mark seemed to me the name that about 50% of the males born into the baby boom were named Mark.
That's me.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, Mark, our listeners, yes.
Yeah.
I'm the same Mark that talked to you earlier, the guy who was blind.
Oh, right.
And also you are a Mark, you know, in the kind of W.C. Field sense of, yes, another Mark, step right up. And so it had multiple connotations for me, that name, Mark. And when I did the Years in Your Ears, it was, the Columbia Graphophone Company was a very early name of Columbia. And I saw this being taken forward into the future as this gigantic cult conglomerate. And as I was listening back, I remember hearing things like Lupolos.
Magnum players.
The idea of a hologram then was very, very new. This is so long ago, your they could now watch the recreation of their choice on their new double-screen TV. Well, what I was reaching for was obviously the idea of cable and the multiple, you know, then there were three networks,
yeah,
three
TV,
local stations.
TV or
you had
TV.
Seven channels on your local station, your local TV.
Yeah, well, that's obviously, yeah, what TV or not TV is about. And we also...
Well, TV or not TV is astonishingly prophetic because
yeah.
what it deals with is public access television. And it is yeah. so right on. I can't, you know, I did this show
sure.
on public access. I went on this public access yeah. show in Seattle just about a month ago before we went on the
I
road.
I
walk into
say.
The place and everybody's naked.
Right.
It was a phenomenon, you know, and I walk in there to plug our Seattle performance. I mean, you know, go anywhere, do anything to sell to sell the show, and I walk in and everybody's naked, and they got on the news the next day because this was so radical. I mean, the camera people were naked and the floor manager, and I said I only take my clothes off. I don't take my clothes off on the first date. I'm sorry.
Wait a minute, David. You say they got on the nudes?
It got on the nudes.
Yes,
right,
the
nude news.
Local
they
nudes.
They were being naked in the naughty 90s.
That's everybody's being... Well, that was the point. The empty 80s
yeah.
is
yeah.
absolutely the truth of the 80s, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And then the naked 90s, dope is coming back, sex is coming back, in spite of the fact that as we entered the 90s, it appeared that sex equaled death.
Raven meets Wolf Woman. Wolf Woman wants to strike a deal. She shows up sitting off to one side. She finds good shells among the little fat rocks. She leaves no prints in the wet moss. She makes no sound in the pine needles. She is the first one to descend a staircase. Wolf Woman can see it in your eyes, wants to strike a deal. Sees to it there's halibut and abalone, follows your home, knows your name, climbs on your bed. She whistles for eagles. Her father's a buffalo. You are surrounded by bears and dark green water, cold as hell. You can only go to the end of the road and back. Time to strike that deal. With the Wolf Woman ceremony, you become Raven in an oily dress coat, funny way of walking, sits like a totem on a pole. Glacier Thunder Maker watches whales' fins arc through the mirror of the dark sky. Wolf Woman grins like a dog. Pearly green northern lights between late dusk and early dawn. The night is full of ducks. Wolf Woman mounts you.
Now, what could be worse than that? Life equals death. No. We're not talking about life here. We're talking about death. Wait a second. Now, all that is beginning slowly here as we get to the middle of the decade. That's beginning to turn around. As Phil joked as we first went on the road, the 90s or the 60s turned upside down. I think that's becoming truer and truer. There is more freedom that is can't be restricted because of the internet, public access,
right.
One man, one channel. Remember, we ran George Buffoon for president in 1976,
right.
And his platform, which was only 3 inches off the ground so nobody could fall off and hurt themselves, his platform was one organism, one vote. That is, if you let the dogs, the cats, the rats,
right.
the bats, and
the one-celled organism,
everybody else, the one-cell organisms vote, you sure as hell are not going to end up with Nixon and Reagan. Because no self-respecting animal is going to vote for them, right?
Right.
Okay,
makes sense.
Part two.
Makes sense.
One organism, one vote. One person, one channel. If everybody has equal access to the media, they can't BS you anymore. Am I right?
Whoa, that is great.
And that
your
is
argument
what's
here.
Happening. All through the internet, there is this true anarchy of communication. And public access, as I have witnessed it, is almost equally anarchic. It's not national broadcast. The FCC doesn't come knocking at your door.
Yeah.
You know, and so long as you don't really insult the audience.
Well, wait a minute, David.
You know,
you
can do pretty much anything you want.
David,
go, Phil.
David, you were on national pubic television.
That's right.
He's right.
You know, but what they were doing, there was this woman who was breastfeeding her baby.
Yep, yeah. That's pubic
access. You know, there were people who were arrested. There were women who were arrested for doing that.
Yes.
Malcolm X, John Lennon? Come on in and dig your mother.
Ah, Mom, I can't now. I gotta go do my homework. I mean, I gotta meet my connection.
You can't fool me. You're in one of those underground study cells, aren't you?
No!
It'll kill your father. I didn't breastfeed you for 14 years for this. Come here, baby.
But, Mom, I'm not hungry.
Straight neck. Do yourself a favor. Be groovy. Now sit down, turn on, and tune in the TV.
But, Mom, I don't want to watch television.
Oh, you're so weird.
There is a famous nude beach in Santa Barbara. Below some cliffs. And the Mexican kids would often just walk up and down the cliff, or sometimes walk the length of the beach. And everyone had their clothes off except these guys. So I had to write a poem about these guys called La Playa. Jóvenes chicanos in white tees or rayon shirts tight and open, dungarees, walk down the beach in threes, drink bud, and look at pussy. Pobrecitos, who never see the sweet chicanas naked, cause the girls come always with baby brothers, little sisters, or infants all their own. Jóvenes chicanos stroll casual and sit on rocks below the cemetery to flash on the brown blondes who walk quivering out of the sea, skin tight as tambourines, here from probably New Jersey or Venus. Then drink their buds down slow and keep on walking.
What is it about radio drama specifically? Because it sounds like you've done a lot of radio drama in your life. That excites you? Like, why radio drama? Why don't you do sort of...
Well, in particular for science fiction, it's so it's so relatively easy to be on the surface of Mars or into in a water world where the creatures are perhaps look something like I don't know, skates. I always thought they were those flat fish with the long tails, you know. It is the best medium for science fiction other than the written word. I think it's quite difficult to make science fiction truly convincing on the screen, although we've all enjoyed, you know, science fiction movies over the years. But audio drama is not the only thing I do. I mean, I have done a lot of that, but I've also done a huge amount of stage and along with the Fire Sign some film and television work as well. So it's but it's the imagination, it's the screen behind your closed eyes, it's that you bring to life the characters, you make the scenes. It's an entirely participatory, talk about interactive, it really is the most interactive of all the media. Instead of being just an audience, you are almost an equal creator with the people who have made the sounds to which you're listening. So that's why.
That's why.
What is it?
It's radio movies.
It's radio movies!
Good evening. Now watch your step, please.
This way to the radio movie soundstage.
Oh, nice to have you with us. Right this way.
Popcorn, popcorn. Get your nice fresh hot.
Hello, and welcome to the radio movie soundstage. I'm David Osmond, and this week our feature is one of the great British high-style comedies, Private Lives by Noel Coward, in a glistening black-and-white production from the BBC. All right, George, we're ready. Yes, here's Act One of Private Lives.
One of the albums, one of my favorites, the one I was turned on first to, was "Don't Crush That Dwarf, Hand Me the Pliers." What was the meaning? How did the title of that come about?
It was something I said, wasn't it?
guys.
Well, yes, but at the same time, I believe a vision of the Virgin Mary had appeared directly above your head. Right,
yeah, that was to me.
It was inside.
Actually, the vision of the Virgin Mary appeared to me in the headliner of a Volkswagen Beetle around 1969, 1970. There it was, and I said, didn't I say this, guys?
Yes.
I said, don't crush that dwarf, hand me the pliers.
Yeah. And then later we were discussing funny songs from the First World War, funny song titles, and there was one which was something like, don't shoot that Hun, have him for breakfast or something, remember?
Yeah. Indeed I do.
And that's when I think you remembered that title, and I remember you saying, you know, don't crush that dwarf, hand me the pliers.
No, here's what it was. It was, we'll be Hieronymus Bosch in a moment, but first.
But Faust.
Faust. Yeah.
But that's
Faust.
Right. We'll be Hieronymus Bosch in a moment, but Faust. That was the original title.
Guys, even in spite of that, it was Phil who said, don't you think we should star George Tirewriter in the next album? To me, in New York. And we did.
Which Phil was that, me or Phil?
No, it wasn't you. It was the other Phil.
Oh, the other one. That was me.
Good. I'm glad.
It's me, the one with the picture of the Virgin Mary tattooed across his forehead.
There you go.
The Amish button collection, the secret button collection.
Somebody told me that had something to do with a roach.
Yeah.
Don't crush that dwarf. You know, hand me a pliers. It's something to do with a roach. Because
It had to do with a television set.
No, it had to do with a TV set. It had to do with the fact that all the little people who worked in the Over the Rainbow movie, okay, Yellow Brick Road movie, who came from all those sex
services throughout
Europe.
There were lots of them, too.
There were lots of them. They were employed riveting inside the wing structures of bombers.
God, you've never let this story go out, Phil. I'm happy to hear it now. Go on.
Listen, people are getting excited. You hear that? There's people are running out of the streets now saying, that's it. That's where it comes from.
Right.
It's those little people inside the wings.
Inside the wings.
For, you know, to save the war.
Hey, people are getting excited, man.
Yeah, I love
God,
that stuff.
Flares are going off on Whidbey Island.
Hey, Dave, let me bring up your days at WBAI in New York.
Bring up my days at WBAI.
I love that soap opera, Bring Up My Days. Have you ever seen that before? It's really good.
Yeah. Now,
Bring Up My Days.
It's interesting. BAI is a very cool, it used to be, I don't know what it is today, very cool, kind of alternative FM station in New York City. Anything used to go. I don't know if that's still true.
It's been taken over by the Baha'is, and it's now WBAI.
No,
it's not a religious station. I'm sorry, I didn't know.
They would hope for that.
See, you guys are all great radio people. You come from a radio background. Talk about the evolution of FM music, rock radio, which is, let's face it, it wasn't talk radio that made you guys and gave you the airplay. It was rock radio. Rock radio, and Firesign Theater, people would listen to you guys like they'd listen to music. They'd party with Firesign Theater like you partied with music.
Well, that was good because we played a lot of music. Robbie Shankar and Janis Joplin going on at the same time.
Oh, but you're thinking about our radio shows, and Alan, you're saying that they actually would put one of our records on as background.
That's what I'm saying. I'm talking about those albums when they came out. Ooh. They blended it into the music. It was a head trip. The stereo separation, the production, the layers on top of layers. It was very trippy.
Yeah, so we can only hope that by doing the same thing, only with contemporary, you know, electronic capabilities, which we've always done, that the same people who were listening to those albums in 1971, 72 would take a look at Immortality or
Dream Dead. They're all dead. They're dead. Their brains have fallen out of their heads from doing too many drugs. They have
It's not the drugs. It's the day trading.
It's the day trading. That's right.
What kills them.
Yeah, it's all that drinking that coffee, staying up late at night, and trying to make a few bucks.
Oh, yeah. It's much... drugs, you know, drugs like, whoa, wow, man, I think, wow, you know, woo-hoo. You know, it's no. Mm-mm.
That's a very interesting description of drug usage there. It's a man who's a woo-hoo. I think you nailed it.
Oh, look, here comes a car.
family to ride with Salamander Mark Time and my anxious android Chucko, the rocket robot, through the black hole of space.
Mark, 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 they're performing experiments on animals in space. Mark, 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 they're performing horrible... Thank you.
Yes, this is going to be another exciting mission, Chucko. We'll be going to the haunted space station for further instructions.
You'll need a crowbar, a crew, Mark.
Right. I need some brave boys and girls who aren't afraid to live outside the law of gravity. Families who like to sleep in tubes and push buttons. Adventurers like you.
I'll slip inside for Mark Time's Outlaw Ghost Ship and further information now, boring. Boarding. Thank you.
Let's go.
Thrill with your friends and family.
No, 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 kid. That's for beaners, you know, boogies, people who like to be alone.
We can run after
it. I got
it.
The clone, kid. Don't worry. Look, look, here comes another one, just like the other one.
As you will remember from our last episode, Mark Time, star detective of the Circumsolar Federation, and his Rocky Jacket sidekick Bob Bunny has been taken as prisoners to the subterranean ice caverns on Jupiter, where the warlord, Prince Acturus, keeps his court and council. Let's join them. Ready? Here we go through Time Warp 2!
Holy moon rocks, Mr. Time. It looks like I've stoked my last atom furnace. There's nothing in the system that I can get help us to down it down here.
If only I hadn't let Doc Technical go off after that stray asteroid by himself. He's so old and stupid.
Well, that's fuel under the reactor now, Mr. Time. Prince Arcturus has us by the thrusters. With you as bait, half the Federation Navy's gonna come blasting in, and the Prince will have him trapped like Mars flies in a Klein bottle.
Ah, that's where you're wrong, Bob. You see, the Lunar Council knows we've been captured. It's up to those Navy boys now to confuse Arcturus and his Mothmen into letting us get control of the communications reactor.
Well, scramble my feedback. But what about Doc?
Dr. Technical is on his own, Bob, right in the middle of the biggest battlefield this old universe
oh,
has ever seen.
Gamma Ray, I wish I could scan him on my video, Mr. Time. He must be mighty hot around the...
In the black reaches of space, a glistening little rocket sub turns slowly over end over end. A power failure has left her helpless. Inside, Dr. Technical races against the sidereal clock to find out the source of the trouble.
Out! That thing blasted to blazes! The trouble ain't in the piles or my piles, and it ain't in the converter. I wish the sunrise had never learned how to pilot one of these space rafts. Never worth a Martian nickel anyway. If I can just jerry-rig a new water pump here. Oh, my glory, there goes the video. How do you turn the darn thing on here?
Attention!
Who's
this
that?
This is Prince Acturus.
Oh, hi.
Men of the Federation, wherever you are, I am now in command. It was useless to send Mark Time and his red-headed friend to spy on me. They have been captured and languish in caves of methane ice 1,000 miles below my fortified palace. You must surrender, men of the Federation. I, Prince Acturus, command it.
Well, if that don't take the rings off a boomer, Mark's in a heap of hot gas now, and I can't do a thing but go round and round in this tin box. Ah, here comes another one.
Prince Acturus. Commander Demoth of the Federation Navy speaking. 1,000 men, mutants, and just plain Joes from little moons all over the universe are ready to chase you back to whatever evil world you came from. Batten down the hatch, Acturus. Here we come.
Well, my stars. Looks like I'm going to miss out on all the exposition and the biggest thing since the Eagle landed. If I can just get this dad-flamed water pump to turn over.
All right, Bob, now you know the plan.
Huh?
The attack's set for daybreak, lunar time. That's about 2 minutes from now. Boy. All right, you get the guard's attention by urinating through the window in the cell door, and I'll knock him out when he comes in. Ready?
I guess if I'm not in orbit now, I'll never be, Mr. Time.
Good, all right. Hold on the pad. Ignition. Blast off!
Can Mark Time and Bob make their childish trick work? Can Dr. Technical get out of the asteroid belt before 2 mighty rocket fleets launch their attacks around him? Who knows? Who cares? Listen next week. Same fire time, same fire station to Mark Time!
I'd like to ask you about your Mark Time character. We just were listening to him. He started out as a ride on your fourth Farsight album, Bozos, and then he was this character we heard, and finally he was the star of your album, How Time Flies. Are these all the same Mark?
Well, they are in a manner of speaking. Actually, he first appeared as the character that you have just heard, as sort of the Flash Gordon,
right?
A superhero character, because we did that on the radio before we did the album, where he appears as a ride. When the entire Firesign got a hold of Mark Time, all four of us writing, he was turned into this a ride in the same sense that the old movies at Universal City are turned into rides. So you have, you know, the Jaws ride or whatever. It was a kind of a failed, tired, leftover idea of this hero. And then when I revived him to do a full-length album with him in 1973 called How Time Flies, then I made him a real person, but also an astronaut. As a matter of fact, the United States' last astronaut who goes to Planet X, he has to go to sleep on that voyage in order to, you know, suspend his animation over time. And when he comes back, he finds that the entire American space program has been eliminated, put to bed, literally, and there's no one to meet him when he gets back on the ground. So there's a way in which they're all astronauts. I mean, we think of the Mark Time that you've heard as being more of a superhero character, but he's just simply an astronaut, just like all those brave guys who went to the moon. And so I had speculated about the end of the space program, which seemed to me at that point, unfortunately, imminent on down the line. I loved the space program because I had been around in the 50s reading science fiction when the whole thing was proposed.
Might I just ask you if you've been following the news today, NASA's announcement of the Martian microbe?
Well, I that was big news today, and I wondered how the phone was ringing over at Ray Bradbury's house today.
Oh, hey, Martian Chronicles, here we go again.
That's right. There have been ads, I think it's General Dynamics or one of the large corporations, there have been full-page color ads in magazines recently about the space station.
Mm-hmm.
Proposed it as a fact, I mean, which presented almost as if it were being built right this minute in outer space, which is a fantasy that I've had, and I've written commercials saying, you know, join us at L5.
Oh, are you an L5 person?
Well, I was when it first came out. Mm-hmm. I never stick with anything too terribly long. I'm not an organization person, except for the Firesign Theater.
All through the career of the Firesign Theater, we have had things that we want to tell people like the ones who've been calling who want to listen, and this record is just another part of that extended line of communication. Yeah. You know, it's all part of all of the things that we want to say about now and then and what's going to happen. So look out.
Everybody knows this is the midst of the disillusionment and heartbreak season, and with a recent outbreak of that suicidal strain of despair up in Boston, well, you'd better keep a close watch on your emotions. So remember the seven danger signals of depression. As a general and lasting feeling of hopelessness, inability to concentrate, loss of self-esteem, fear of rejection, misdirected anger, feelings of guilt, and extreme dependency on others. At the first sign of these symptoms, friends, follow these simple rules. Keep working, drink as much as possible, and take your television's advice. And you know, more TVs recommend an amazing new psychic breakthrough than any other, and that's confidence in the system. Fast, safe, and guaranteed by constant federal control, confidence in the system will keep them in power longer, 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 and tend to calm and obscure the miseries of disillusionment and despair. Confidence in the system, in easy-to-swallow propaganda form, a new fast-acting thought control. So have some today.
Rolling tape. 51.
All right, old buddy.
should just be toughened into consciousness now, and you just want to keep still while you warm up. Assuming the system doesn't cut in on us, it ought to take about 3 minutes from now. All right, I'm going to start a count.
100.
You're counting back now.
98,
focus both eyes on the PSI indicator light.
96. 95.
Now, buddy,
94,
I know it's been a long haul for you.
92,
the system should be running some figures now on the vitals.
90,
if you're still on the green, we'll do the memory test.
87.
And restore the con to you, Cap.
85. 84.
End tape 51.
System in. Hello, Mark. You are
A-OK.
Punch up. BMF.
Perform.
Basic manual function.
Clip. You are
A-OK.
Mark.
Do not.
Voice operate.
System.
Please. You are
not
in
control.
Rolling tape.
52.
Happy New Year, Mark. This is Angela, and we're going to let you wake up to some really schmoozy programming. But first, let's do a memory check. Pipe up. Don't worry about being groggy. I know you'll be doing just fine. I've got a funny one for you. Channel 001. Who was Dewey Duck?
Huh?
System in
your
audio
out.
Repeat.
What?
System indicate
failure.
Difficulty
failure
in
mic drain battery.
Repeat
count
ding please.
Testing 4. Testing 5.
Good morning.
Dewey was Donald's nephew. At least that's what he and Daisy claimed. And if anybody's listening down there, I've got a terrible backache here.
That's right, Mark. Now, on the red channel, read the system your vitals.
Mark T, Captain, signs of life, green, elapsed time of sleep in 24-hour units, 3, 4, 3, 2.
And I'm mighty glad to be awake, too.
Listen, I can remember it.
On center. We'll be seeing you in just a little while.
We're here now. And we'll probably still be home to say hello, old buddy. God, run.
You just do grass until your muscles come back. The system will roll an exciting new entertainment tape for you. Bye-bye.
Keep sewing, Mark. MK 52.
System in.
Hello, Mark.
Entertainment
delay. Check
your
audio.
Again, please.
Testing.
This sounds real bad,
system. Can you plug the drain?
No.
I'm out of communication.
You are
out.
I'm out of communication.
Failure.
Not
A.
Difficulty.
Landing phase.
A-OK.
Rolling tape.
53.
There's, you know, retirement for an artist is impossible. I mean, in the first place, you haven't been working for anybody all your life, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so there's no retirement check coming in the mail.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to make it as you go along, as well as just the fact that you have to keep being creative, keep working. And that's my advice. Keep working.
But just to give you a little picture of Hollywood, I wrote a series of poems called L.A. One Night Stanzas. And one of them is called Crossroads of the World. Crossroads of the World is a place in Hollywood, which, right on Sunset Boulevard, which is kind of a one-story movie set version of old half-timbered houses with a kind of art moderne ship running right down the middle of them. It looks like the back lot of a Hollywood soundstage. And it was an office complex. And the interesting thing about it was that my father had actually worked at Crossroads of the World in 1940. 1941. It had an office in this place, and when I came to have an office there to write a movie in, it was that was a, one of those odd returns that you get in life. Repeated returns, the I Ching says. Crossroads of the world. Disco on the radio, finger poppin' Arab fry cooks, posses of actors out searching, smoking marijuana, wearing Chinese shoes, listening to Benny Goodman, drinking coffee in a room full of women, eating green cherries at sunset, watching a TV travel at 65 northbound, whores and dwarves hard by the boulevard, rock stars in 50s cars. Universal must have paid for the moon. And another one called H-Wood 80s. Unmistakably hash pipe smoking in the park where Rudolph Valentino and three soft-eyed bums share the grass. Valley Jews and children of the rich, one-night papas make burgers with the kids due for whole weekends of real life. Tonight, the Hollywood boulevards unroll toward sunset, Washington palms against a planetarium sky, fading toward a truly mournful Jap saxophone.
Here are the, this is, I'm just opening it. He goes to a rap party at his producer's house. That's a guy named Gus Lemming. This was back in 1945. And it's just kind of funny, the people who were at this party. I'm reading from his book. Beyond the gate, I could see a sapphire pool surrounded by famous faces and infamous bodies. A long bar with white-coated Filipino waiters doing chilly things with good gin. And Gus himself holding court with his stooges, the three you know about and half a dozen others who ran Paranoid Pictures for him. Hiya, Georgie. Mae West sidled up alongside me. Is that a microphone in your pocket, Georgie, or are you just glad to see me? I gave Mae a twirl. Gus's big console phonograph was playing Kugat's new one, the Walter Winchell Roomba, and passed her on with an exchange of sexy winks to Jerry Colonna. I'm daring Dolly to a duel, George, he stage whispered. Lip fur at 20 paces. Salvador Dali made a surreal pair with Alfred Hitchcock at the bar. The painter of soft women and soft watches was in town to dream up some nightmares for Spellbound, and his oiled mustachios vibrated like rhinoceros horns in the brilliant flashes of lightning from the pool. You can't win unless you melt his wax, Jerry, I said, taking May back for a spin that came so close to the edge of the deck that Chico Marks nearly pulled us into the deep end. May said, I like my lip fur shaved close and kissable. She spun back to Jerry, and I was on my way to join Jack Houseman at the bar when Chico splashed past me out of the pool and settled into a deck chair next to Lemming. Hey, Gus, the baby! Gus loved it when Chico used his sliced salami dialect. What you want of me, Chick? Is it true, what do they say? You thought Georgie Tirebiter was Charlie McCarthy when he come in to see you on his first day at Paranoid? That's a good a joke, huh, boss? Huh? Gus tried to laugh around his 7-inch Romeo y Julieta cigar. George walks into my office and I say, you the new office boy? Geez, didn't I tell you I wanted an egg salad and a lemon Coke, for crap's sake? Right, George? Right, Gus. And a wastebasket is full again, I told him. And George says, and I said, I'm Georgie Tirebiter, Mr. Lemming. You hired me from radio, remember? Yeah, and I says, you? I tell him to get me the new awesome Wells, and they send me the old Henry Aldrich. The Flax and Stooges laughed, and why not? I set him up for the punchline. My topper's timing was a steal from Jack Benny. So I emptied the wastebasket. There's nothing like leaving on a good laugh, and I did.
Oh, boy.
He was there in the golden age of Hollywood, with really surrounded by all the stars.
I was laughing, but I turned my mic down.
Hello?
Good morning, Mr. Tirebiter. This is your service. Time to wake up.
Oh, that's all right, my dear. I've been up all night watching myself on the TV.
Oh.
I don't suppose there'd be any messages for me this morning.
Just a moment. Yes, sir, there
There are some. A Mr. Sennett called.
Mr. Sennett?
And a Mr. Keaton, Babe Hardy, Stan Jefferson,
Stan,
and Mr. Dunkerfield, or a Mr. Roach. Am I going too fast?
Mr. Roach? Oh, no, no, I'm remembering. I'm remembering them all. This is wonderful. Is there anyone else?
Well, there was a Mr. Turpin, a Mr. Fetchett. Oh, and a Mr. He wouldn't leave his name.
Oh,
Mr. Lloyd.
Just a moment. I have to go get an ice cream cone. Hold on, I'll be right back.
Mr. Tarwater?
So hungry. Goodness, you came up into the hill. Hey, wait for me!